Stephen Esposito is the president of Yellowstone Wealth Management in Lake Forest. He's a regular guest, and he tells producer Peep that there's not a lot of confidence in the Fed today. Hey, Stephen, why do you say that? Welcome back.
Hi, John. How are you? Glad to be here. It's, you know, let's face it, they've been all over the map over the last 2-3 years. They admitted that they kept rates too low for too long and created an inflation issue, and now in 1 minute, the street thinks there's going to be 7 cuts. Now we're talking 3 cuts or no cuts. Even after talk of raising rates, I don't know where that's going to be. It's not the place I'm at right now, but there's just no confidence. And when there's no confidence, markets reflect that. And that's what you got to worry about. So that's why there's volatility the last couple of days.
But confidence in the Fed seems to me to bespeak of a judgment on the people making these decisions about interest rates. Is it that the Fed is making mistakes, or is it that nobody has a crystal ball? Nobody could accurately forecast maybe how many cuts you're going to make in a given year.
Oh, of course, right. But the problem is so many different Fed governors come on television and give a different answer, which I think confuses investors going back and forth. There's no coordination between them, because they all have different opinions. And you're right, nobody knows. It's been a heck of last four years have been something you wouldn't even imagine in a movie. But right now, we're in a different phase. You have a lot of people who have not participated in the upside of this market. Investors who purchased a lot of fixed income in the last couple of years have seen substantial losses. And there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines, $6 or $7 trillion in money markets, not to mention CDs and other investment vehicles, that is earning a good rate of return, but it's not going to get them to retirement. So they're waiting to deploy capital. And if we get that pullback from the Fed saying something or doing something to cause the markets to drop, it could be an opportunity for people who haven't been fully invested to start looking that way, considering where it fits in their portfolios.
You rooting for that? You hoping for a market drop?
No, not really, but we're braced for one. We always keep a substantial amount of dry powder, as they say, while our other portfolios are working. You never know when something's going to happen in the economy, and it's always good to have that balance. So if there is, we're prepared to take advantage of it. If there's not, we're full invested where we want to be. So we don't try to earn the highest rates of returns. We definitely don't want the lowest. We want to be somewhere people are comfortable and they can sleep at night in the way the portfolio.
Well, why do you say that people who made fixed rate purchases are losing right now?
Well, depending on when you purchase. You purchase, bonds or bond funds, things along those lines, depending on where you deploy your capital. A lot of fixed income vehicles are lower today because when rates were down at 1%, rates went up. And many of those vehicles have gone negative. And sadly, it'll be a long time before a lot of them return to par, the longer-term maturities. And some of those vehicles are just directly related to rates. And when you go from 1% to 5%, that's a dramatic move in the bond market. So the longer the maturities, typical kind of fund. So there's a lot of people still are underwater on the principal in that world.
I was just thinking that a lot of people are enjoying 5% on a T-bill or an I-bond right now.
Correct. Those who had the capital to deploy capital into those areas now, and the money market's great. We have a lot of money sitting in money markets right now. Earnings are great, sitting on the sideline rate of return, and we like it. It's a good rate of return for sitting down doing nothing.
So the difference is when you bought them, in other words.
Absolutely. So absolutely.
Talk to me about
investing, timing is everything, right?
Talk to me about the relationship between bullish investors and bears right now.
Well, right now, I just read a survey actually today talking about the amount of the association, AAII, individual investors, basically did a survey, and it showed that the average investor is very bullish on the market. And while many of them, believe it or not, aren't on the economy and are worried about inflation, many are bullish, and the ratio was something like 62%. That number today scares me a little bit when that many people are bullish. It's historically been a contrarian indicator. So I'm not sure if they're, what sectors. It doesn't break it down to sectors, but that makes me a little bit nervous. So I'm glad I have some capital there. So when I see that number drop where most people are bearish is when we really like to deploy more capital. We're contrarians. We're contrarians.
Evidently.
Yeah, that's how we do things here.
So if everybody says, I think things are going swell, that makes you nervous. And if everybody says, oh, gee, I think times are tough, you see opportunity.
Right.
Well, I see the latter part of that. But I am happy when people are happy. when people are confident, I'd like to borrow from that.
Well, remember, we were a year ago. A year ago, we had a banking crisis. we were going to see another banking crisis. Yeah. We had three bank failures, and everybody was scared of the economy and the potential domino effect of the banks. And we talked about getting involved in the banks, and we did. And knock on wood, right now it's doing very well.
Yeah.
Deploying capital when everybody's scared, just knowing how to go in there or have experience. I think the experience makes a bigger difference. Being through 9 stock market crashes in 40 years, after the first 3 market crashes, you start to get a little bit more confident, and you look at them in a different way. So I think where we're at now in the economy is strong, better than most everybody thought. And I still believe you'll see 2 or 3 rate cuts, I'm hoping. I'm hoping the Fed finds a happy medium to make everybody feel good, not too much, not too little, as we go into the second half of the year. And I think that would help the markets dramatically in the end. Now, I don't know what they're going to do. I'm hoping that they'll do 2 or 3 cuts.
Yeah,
well, and
that's what we're hearing, too. Stephen Esposito is the president at Yellowstone Wealth Management in Lake Forest, YellowstoneWM.com. Stephen, nice to talk to you today.
Thank you.
Philip Weiss is the president of Seyfarth at Work, and the headline for Philip today is Leaving the Office Loner Alone. Hi, Philip. Welcome back.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
So what's an office loner?
You know, office loaner is something of a new phenomenon, at least in terms of how often companies are talking about these individuals. And your listeners may know someone or be someone who is, in fact, the office loner. In the wake of remote work and with increasing days in the office, a lot of our clients, including the HR leaders, are telling us that they're getting requests from people who say, look, I really reveled in the times I could just control my schedule, be by myself, work in solitude. These solo flyers feel often cajoled to be back in the office and pressured to be with other people. And so it's been an interesting and sometimes a rocky road, John, for companies to find the right balance in terms of how to manage people who aren't comfortable with the crowds that are in the offices these days.
Well, how did we manage these people previous to the pandemic?
Well, it's really interesting. There's some theories flying around in that regard. And I think part of it, from what we're gathering, is many individuals found themselves, found their capacity to be more productive, found ways to be more creative when they were put outside the office setting. And so they're now bridling at the fact that they're being forced to be in the sort of the scrum of the population at work. So it's not as though they were not being managed before. It's now that they are demanding something different because they experienced something different. And just to give you a quick example of how that kind of manifests itself, how that looks in the real world, an Illinois consulting company came to us with issues dealing with the office loner. A manager who previously had no issue managing this person pre-COVID found that they were being put in a position where they kept inviting this office loner to meetings because they wanted to fully integrate them. The office loner was feeling suffocated, and while they started out as the best performer, they turned into the least productive. And that was a direct result of what they had experienced working independently versus the pressure of the crowd back at work. So it's a new reality for many managers dealing with the same exact employees.
We experience this with younger people. Students going back to school have had trouble integrating, but I hadn't thought about that in terms of adults.
Yeah, and I don't think a lot of bosses have thought about this in terms of more tenured employees. Harvard conducted a study just last year, John, and they looked at introverts, the people that we're really thinking about here as the office loners. And they found after conducting brain scans that there's more frontal lobe activity where the deep analysis, rational thought, planning occurs, which tells us a couple things. One is these people are not making up the fact that they do better work when left alone. It's a chemical reality in their brain. And when managers realize that and realize they're actually failing to leverage people's skills when they demand too much, check in too often, have too many social events and expect everyone to be there, they're going to get better work product out of these same people. So it's really interesting.
Well, one last thing for you to comment on, because I know people like this who tend to, at the office, exist in a rather solitary state, are terribly productive, positive people. My concern for them is I hope they're having a nice day. I hope they enjoy coming to work. And it's hard to maybe assess that when it's a person who tends to work with the door closed. But they can be terribly productive. I wonder if the managers or fellow employees are just trying to give them a more positive work experience.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, because it's not about leaving them entirely alone. It's about finding out the kind of check-in moments and frequency and kind of feedback and recognition that that office owner will really want and build from positively. So managers who figure this out, they're really flexible in their approach in terms of how much they engage with this office loaner, but they don't leave them their own devices. If you don't give somebody guidance, they're not going to do the job. Yeah. And your point is many of these people are fully respectful, want to be engaged, but need that flexible management approach.
Okay, Philip Weiss, president of Seyfarth at Work, Seyfarth, Seyfarth at Work. Nice to talk to you, Philip.
Thanks for having me, John.
Dennis Rodkin is the senior reporter covering residential real estate for Crain's Chicago Business. He's a regular guest on the Business Lunch. He's here today with more housing news. How you been?
I'm great, John. How are you?
You were in Indianapolis at the Motor Speedway yesterday.
For the eclipse, we were. I was a little skeptical about whether that was the place to see it, but there was a NASA tie-in. They had big screens with NASA narration, not during totality in Indianapolis, but prior to and after. So it was as if you were kind of watching it cross the country with NASA experts, and then you got your own experience in the middle of what was actually happening.
And?
It was pretty remarkable. It was, I mean, you know what's going to happen, but even so, when the sun goes out in the middle of the day and then comes back, it was quite remarkable. It was, I mean, we really did have totality. We went from full sun to full dark and back to full sun in the course of about 10 minutes.
And as you know, here in Chicago with 94% totality, it didn't get dark at all. And I wonder how quickly did you go from the kind of brightness we had to totality? Was it relatively rapid? Like, hey, the sun is out. Hey, it's all of a sudden it's dark. How quickly did you get to totality?
It was gradual and then it was quick. So as much as an hour before you saw, when you were looking through the glasses, you saw a sliver of the sun missing.
Well, we did too.
And as it approached, you saw it get a little dimmer. I think some people perceived it as more dim than I did. So it's going gradually. But then in those last couple of minutes, it goes very abruptly. I mean, you really saw, it was as if the lights went out.
Isn't that, to me, that's pretty cool. And did you notice a temperature drop?
It didn't feel like it dropped all that much to me. Other people said it dropped about 10 degrees, but you did feel, it felt like a summer evening.
One of the reports I read, which made me laugh, was at first there was a hush because people were awed and experiencing it, and then they started to howl like wolves.
Oh, our crowd applauded. But you know what I thought was really good was, so there's all this NASA narration, but there are also people around you with boom boxes who've brought their own soundtrack.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, right.
So you've got like hard rock over here and 80s music over there, and you're thinking, you're going to ruin this experience for me. But everybody was, we were in Indianapolis, everybody was pretty respectful. The music really went off as things got serious, and then it came back on. So I think most people really were aware. We're in sort of a group event. I don't want to mess it up by playing
Dark Side of the Moon.
My music, whatever it was for you.
I mean, I told people where to queue up Pink Floyd so that they would have the best crescendo at the totality moment. One last thing then. What was the traffic like coming and going?
We skipped it. We drove down on Sunday and drove back this morning before work.
Did you stay in a motel or did you camp?
Yeah, we stayed in a hotel.
What'd you pay?
Twice what they normally charge.
That's better than what I heard. The Motel 6 was $1,600.
Oh, wow.
They were advertising that.
Well, we booked pretty far in advance. We knew we were going. We probably booked about 5 weeks in advance. But even then, you could see It's kind of like watching the sun go out and come back up. You could see the hotel prices on the schedule go up and come back down right on the last few days.
Dennis Rodkin is the senior reporter covering eclipses at Crain's Chicago Business. He also covers the real estate scene. RJ Melman, the president of Let Us Entertain You's household. Condo.
Quickly, house. Yeah, a house on Bellevue.
Was that a house?
They bought this house, then they bought a condo, then they put this house on the market, and they have now sold this house. So that's where the confusion lies. A couple of years ago, R.J. Melman, who's the head of the company his father co-founded half a century ago, Let Us Entertain You, and his wife, Catherine, had a house on Bellevue that they bought several years ago.
Where's Bellevue?
Bellevue's on the Gold Coast.
Okay.
They bought a condo on Oak Street for about $6 million, put this on the market for 4.9 and sold it for 4.9. It was only on the market for about a month. So it's remarkable because RJ Melman is a name in the restaurant business, in the business, hospitality business in Chicago. It's also been owned by Kenny Williams of the White Sox and Zoraida Sambolin, the broadcaster. It's also been owned by Bill and Juliana Rancic, the TV personalities. But also remarkable is that it sold in a month. We're not seeing that on the Gold Coast, and it sold at full price. I have sat here with you and talked about properties that were on the market a year, 2 years, 3 years on the Gold Coast and sell at dramatic discounts. This sold millions of dollars in discounts. We had one sell for half price, half of what the sellers were asking. This sold at the full price in a month.
Did they drop a lot of money on it? That is improving it?
That actually came several years ago. Bill and Juliana Rancic were the people who remodeled it. They did. It had been a little bit run down. They brought it up to date, made it very stylish, sold it to Williams and Sambolin, who sold it to the Melmans. It's mostly the way they had it. I think they've actually dialed it back a little bit. It had lots of very bold wallpaper when the Rancics did it, and now it's a little bit more neutral, but it's a beautiful old house, built in the 1860s or the 1890s, I'm sorry, I can't remember which. Really nice row house on Bellevue where there are a lot of great historical homes. Looks good. One of the things the Rancics upgraded was this nice terrace off the back where you really flow right out of the back of the house as if it's a suburban home up onto this covered and walled terrace. So you've got privacy, but views. Really, really pretty. Cook out there. There's a fireplace out there. It's got a lot of things that, I still say, oh, it feels like a suburban home, but we have so many of those now in the city that I should probably change my vocabulary.
That's one way to judge maybe the value of a property or the owners is, do you have a decent yard in the city?
Yeah.
If you've got real estate and you're just using it for grass, you've got money to spend, right?
Right. And so this doesn't actually have grass. If there's anything green, it would be AstroTurf because it's above the ground.
Oh, okay. So this outdoor space you're describing.
That's above the garage.
No. Oh, really? Okay. Well, kudos to them. What about this St. Regis condo, which sold for 1.2?
Sold for $1.2 million off what people paid for it just a couple of years ago. St. Regis is this tower, actually a few blocks from us, designed by Jeannie Gang. Beautiful, sort of undulating towers. Somebody bought a condo there for about $8.2 million when the building was new and just sold it for $7
million. I'm sorry, I'm not laughing. Those numbers are all hard for me to get my head around.
I think it's probably hard to get your head around losing $1.2 million in a couple of years. At what was really one of the premier luxury buildings in our market. It's a little surprising. I don't know. We don't have a pattern yet because there haven't been many resales. The building is quite new. We are seeing a lot of them. We are seeing some of the new units sell for less than what they used to be priced at, but that's not quite the same thing as a resale price, which really clarifies where the market is. As far as I know, these sellers never moved in. They put it on the market almost immediately after buying it. It's been on the market for a couple of years.
What is that?
I'm guessing. I don't know because they didn't speak to me. I'm guessing they were investor buyers. I don't have any confirmation
right.
of that.
Well, it was 6,000 square feet. They bought the 78th floor, right?
Yeah. And, there's a lot of when a condo development is going up, there are investor buyers who think this is going to be worth more when the building opens or shortly after the building opens than it is now. I'm getting a great price when it's new or not yet completed. And that this play, if that's what they were doing, didn't quite work out. The primary reason to think that's what they were doing is that they put it on the market something like 2 months after they bought it.
Well, then maybe that's not too worrisome to whoever's managing that property. Somebody speculated, guessed wrong on what the high end would be, but maybe those people who are buying at whatever the list prices are on more reasonable, you know, million-dollar properties will see appreciation. That is a gorgeous building.
It is, yeah. And I think if you're there for the long term, you can expect some kind of a return. This was a surprise when it popped up onto my feed that it had gone for significantly less than it did just a couple of years ago.
Okay, stay right there. Dennis Rodkin in our studio, senior reporter covering real estate for Crain's Chicago Business. Let's cover more business on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The tech job market in Chicago is expected to see a rebound in 2024 after layoffs and a venture capital funding slowdown last year. CompTIA, a nonprofit association for the information tech industry and workforce, says the Chicago area could see a nearly 1% increase in tech jobs this year. That would be about 2,135 jobs. That job growth would rank Chicago 22nd among major U.S. metros. New York City and Dallas are expecting the most growth. Chicago has the ninth largest tech force in the nation. The city lost about 700 jobs last year. Chicago-based climate tech company LanzaTech Global is one of 33 recipients across 20 states who could share $6 billion in funding from the U.S. Department of Energy. The money will fund projects focusing on commercial-scale decarbonization. LanzaTech has developed a carbon recycling technology that converts carbon waste into sustainable fuels and chemicals. The end result could be production of sustainable ethylene from captured carbon dioxide. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, and as advertised, listen to this. Business of Food from Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and here we are, finally. March Madness is over in April. But without agriculture, there would have been no madness, at least as we know it. More about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, the role of agriculture in basketball. Well, some of these are layups. The wood for the floors and cotton for uniforms, cotton and leather for shoes, leather for the balls, although college uses a composite leather. The NBA still uses all leather, which comes from Horween Leather Company right here in Chicago. The first hoop was a peach basket. They didn't hold up too well, and steel hoops came along. But in the 60s and 70s, players were dunking, and those rims were being bent and pulled down. And that is where Art Errett of Verdon, Illinois, entered hoops history.
And he said, you know, there ought to be some way to keep that from happening.
That's John Beatty, a farmer near Springfield and friend of Mr. Errett, who passed away in 2015. He was the manager of the local co-op elevator. And over their morning coffee one day in 1975, they decided to go to Beatty's insulated and heated farm shop and work on Errett's idea for a breakaway rim.
We tried a lot of different things. Eventually, he came to this design that it is today.
The design that worked best was with springs from a John Deere cultivator that they altered in Mr. Beatty's shop.
It was a hit-and-miss deal.
Mr. Errett applied for a patent in 1976, and after some exhibitions of the rim, which he called the Rebounder, it started being used in games.
Really, one of the first times they were really used officially was in a little Waverly High School in the Waverly Tournament, Christmas Tournament.
And after Daryl Dawkins broke a couple of backboards, the NBA adopted the breakaway rim, which Mr. Errett had licensed and was being mass-produced.
He contracted with Puffy.
Did you ever hang on the rim, Mr. Beatty?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not a very big guy. I only weigh about 125, and it was all I could do to pull it down. These big boys pull them down now. They come right back. They come right back.
And as you're watching the slam dunkers and rim hangers, remember, it all started on a farm in Sangamon County. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Dennis Rodkins here, senior reporter covering residential real estate for Crain's Chicago Business. We have talked about New Buffalo before. What's the story there now?
This is sort of an after effect of a lot of the stories we've discussed. New Buffalo has really been a booming market for second home buyers and also buyers of properties that they're going to put on the short-term rental market. And a couple of years ago, there was a crisis over there where locals were saying, we're being priced out. New Buffalo is pretty small, doesn't have a huge housing market, and we're being pushed out by the second homes, by the short-term rentals. So now there's sort of a response in New Buffalo Township, which is not the town of New Buffalo, but right outside. The school has owned about 40 acres across the street for over 20 years. They bought it to use for their building trades program to have students build houses. Now what they're doing is they appear to be ready to, they haven't yet confirmed that they're going to contract with a developer who's going to build affordable housing, build what they call attainable housing, no subsidies involved, but housing that teachers, store owners, restaurant owners can afford. They're right outside downtown New Buffalo in New Buffalo Township, building about 99, 15 of which would still be built by the building trades program of the school. So the school district is still getting what it intended to do two decades ago. But people who can't afford, who work in New Buffalo or near New Buffalo, but can't afford housing would be the target for this new development.
What do one of those houses look like then? Square footage or cost?
They're three bedrooms. They haven't yet talked about price. We're real early in the process. Yeah. In fact, the developers wouldn't talk to me. Only officials in New Buffalo would. They haven't said yet. It looks as if some would be for sale, some for rent. No prices, but they are no prices announced yet. But they are talking about three bedrooms. They want this to be family housing. Three bedrooms, two car garages. Lots of walking trails and natural areas so that it has that New Buffalo ethos. And one of the stipulations the school board wants in the HOAs of the homes is you can't put them on the short-term rental market.
No Airbnbs.
Right. Because that's really been the problem with downtown New Buffalo, with
New
Buffalo proper.
Will they let people from Chicago buy these properties?
It's difficult to prohibit people from buying them as second homes, but they're trying to figure out how they can sort of make it more attractive to people who are going to use them as first homes. One of the ways to do that is they want to have a master lease between the developer and the school district so that there is always some housing available for teachers.
Maybe this isn't a good problem to have, but New Buffalo is so perfectly located that they had the problem of a lot of people from Chicago wanting to go there and buy real estate and spend money there.
Right.
And the mayor, of all people, didn't want that much. He was very prickly about that when he spoke to us. And I think he was in a damned if you do or don't situation because he wanted to protect the locals and the real estate market, making it affordable. But, dude, we are begging to come and spend money in your town. Why are you being so mean to us?
Yeah, I get it. And he was prickly to me when I was covering those stories as well. But yes, I think it's damned if you do and damned if you don't. You need those people. First of all, you need locals just because you need the continuity. But you also need locals who are going to be the teachers, the firefighters, the restaurant owners, that sort of thing. And so this is kind of what I think of it as a pressure valve, a pressure release, because the problem is you just don't have the supply for both the people who are coming in from Chicago saying, I want a second home, and the locals. So then if you build 99 new units of housing, that's a way, if you can keep the second home buyers and the short-term rental investors from buying them, that's a way to sort of accomplish that goal of keeping people in town.
This sounds like a good idea. Dennis Rodkin is here. He's a senior reporter covering residential real estate at Crain's. Come in again, Dennis. Nice to see you.
I will. Thanks, John.